Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Consenting Sexualities Team Social Media and Anti-Violence Activism Symposium, co-organized by SMA Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies, and also with the Canadian Women's Foundation. I'm really excited about this afternoon's talk. This is the first time we've actually worked with Professor Sharif, and we're really excited to start what I hope will be more engagements and more activities. So I'm going to get right to the introduction so that I can turn it over to Professor Sharif and our respondent today as well, who I'll also introduce to you now. Dr. Sharif is an international authority on emerging social, legal, and policy issues that are related to social media use by youth, and she's a professor here in the Faculty of Education. Her research and teaching are grounded in the study of law as it impacts education, public policy, and digital citizenship. She's principal investigator on five collaborative national and international projects on cyberbullying and digital citizenship, and she's the author of the book Cyberbullying, Issues and Solutions in the School, the Classroom, and the Home, and Confronting Cyberbullying, What Schools Need to Know to Control Misconduct and Avoid Legal Consequences. Professor Sharif directs the research program Define the Line, which you see on the screen here, at McGill, which aims to clarify the blurred lines between cyberbullying and digital citizenship with a focus on policymaking, education, and law. The research group also looks at the criminalization of sexualized selfies, or sexts, that Professor Karan spoke with us about yesterday as well. So I think this will be a nice extension of a conversation we began yesterday. We're also really delighted to have Professor Biela Coleman with us today to provide a response to Professor Sharif's presentation. Professor Coleman is the Wolf Chair in Scientific and Technological Literacy in the Art, History, and Communications Department at McGill University. I'm delighted she's my colleague in that department. Trained as an anthropologist, she researches, writes, and teaches on hackers and digital activism. She's the author of the book Coding Freedom, The Aesthetics and the Ethics of Hacking on the Free Software Movement, and is currently at work on the book about the group Anonymous and digital media activism. And Anonymous, it's been interesting, some of the cases that we've been talking about around this conference, Anonymous has been absolutely central to the Steubenville, Ohio case in particular. So it's an interesting way to think about what's the relationship between feminism and Anonymous. She has also published on ethnographic approaches to digital media, the indie media movement, WikiLeaks, and intellectual property law. Professor Sharif's talk today is titled Defining the Lines Between Free Expression, Privacy, Safety, and Regulation, and I turn the podium over to her.
Thank you very much, Kerry, and thank you for having me at this conference, and thank you to all of you for being here on a Friday afternoon to be at this presentation. I'm a little bit out of sorts today. We had a death in the family, and so I just a little bit a little upset. I want to dedicate this talk to Parin Sharif, who would have been here. She came to a lot of my talks. She lived right on Green in Sherwood, Sherbrooke, and had really helped me settle in to Montreal when I first came here in 2004. So I would like to at least dedicate this talk to her, as she's not able to come. I wish I had been at the earlier presentations, especially the one with respect to criminalization of sexting and these kinds of issues. What I want to do today is talk about the context and emerging legal concerns regarding digital communication. How those forms of communication are rooted in the notion of cyberbullying. I personally don't like. Can I pick this up and move because I walk because I'm a pacer. So actually, can you hear me? Because if you can hear me, then that's fine.
For the recording, it would be better if you stay.
Better if I stay there.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try.
Does it come off?
Yeah, it probably does.
Is it wired or is it wireless?
It's kind of taped. It's okay. You know what? I'll try and keep still. it just helps me think to pace. Okay. So Cyberbullying, first of all, I don't like the word cyberbullying. It's become too overused, and the whole idea of cyber makes you think of negative connections. And so the way that I have started looking at these issues is to look at them in terms of the kinds of legal frameworks that might apply to the forms of communication. And I want to make it very clear that I'm very supportive of online communications, digital media, engaging young people in digital media and communications, and engaging in critical analysis of social norms that have developed and emerged with digital media, as well as critical legal literacy is one of the key aspects that I want to emphasize and am emphasizing. What has happened is, so I'm going to talk about some of the roots, the sexualization of teenage girls and how that is being responded to. Maybe I should put this back.
And how
that's being responded to, and then look at the emerging legal and educational considerations, assumptions about protecting the privacy of the girls who have been victimized by in some of the cases that you're well aware of, Amanda Todd, Rattaya Parsons, those kinds of cases, and I'm going to discuss those two and a couple of others, and then the continued impact of online distribution once their victimization has been publicized, how that continues and how it appears repeatedly, how it's stored and repeatedly appears, gets passed on, and how they're re-victimized. I've brought with me a brief that a number of legal academics across Canada, that there's about five or six of us that are working on policy, advising policymakers and especially the federal government. And we recently submitted in June when we thought that Prime Minister Harper was going to actually debate the changes to the criminal code. We had submitted a policy brief through a senator who has been very supportive to us. And then Jim Nicholson, who was Minister of Justice, moved on, and now Peter McKay is there. And Peter McKay has basically said that he wants to adopt a holistic approach before he develops any kind of national law or strategy, which I think is a great idea, and I really hope that he's read our brief, but if not, we're going to push it, and also we want him to really consider whether we really need new and specific laws to address these issues, because as far as I'm concerned, the legal frameworks already exist. And this criminalization and legislation is coming, I mean, whether we like it or not, and I want to talk about some of the pressures on government to implement these laws. And like it or not, because they're coming, we need to look at legal literacy, not only of young people, but of all the stakeholders involved, educators, parents, administrators. And especially we need to look at helping. What I really want to do as part of my research and that we're doing is to sensitize the legal community, that is law enforcement officers, prosecutors, lawyers, judges, to really understand the complexities and the challenges that young people confront these days, how they are understanding social media, that they're growing up as digital natives, as Prensky defined in 2001. They're immersed in a digital media. This is young people's, the generation anywhere from 0 to even 30 now, most young people who are in the audience, you've been immersed in your lives. You can't imagine a world without digital media. So digital immigrants like older people like myself, seem to have some of those mental blocks when it comes to using these media. And that plays into how some of the judges and lawyers and people in the legal community will address these issues. So ultimately, there's been a policy vacuum in the last 10 years, ever since I started looking at these issues, in terms of how do you balance in an online forum, in a public sphere, free expression, equality, safety, privacy, and regulation, or what's happening in many cases, over-regulation or reactive regulation. Basically, it's also about distinguishing between the law's objectives relating to actual online child sexual predators. So here I'm talking now about sexting and the fact that police are applying child pornography laws to dealing with and addressing postings, online postings by young people where they'll spread semi-nude photographs or videotapes sent to them in trust and confidence. And I've got a video to show, a two-minute clip that we've developed, where they'll spread this. What we've found in our research is largely that young people, digital natives, often don't think about the impact or don't even think about these things. What's happened is that it becomes a competition in many, many of these cases. It's actually a competition between the kids who are posting this stuff online and without them really thinking about how it's harming the individual at the other end. What happens is the victim, the female victim, is dehumanized, and the justification becomes the posting of threats and insults and that kind of... And quite often it's become a competition about who can post the worst insults. And I think it's an important discussion that we need to have about that, you know, where is that line between the jokes and teasing? And we have to get young people engaged in thinking about these things. And later in one of the later slides, I've got that clip from the St. Mary's University where they, you know, the frosh where they were singing about these things. I remember many years ago when my children were teenagers and we were in a car, we're driving somewhere, I remember, and there was a rap song going and it was saying, shut up, lie down, shut up, lie down, lie down. And I said to the kids, well, they had a CD in there. And I said, what is this? You know, are you thinking about the words? Or they were singing along, you know, just because it was, because I think quite often the connection isn't made. And so that's one of the issues. And then determining which legal frameworks apply to address these child pornography laws. Child pornographers are actually, obviously, they are focusing their entire attention on molesting children. There are physical consequences there. In relation to what's going on in terms of rapes as well that are posted of young girls being drugged and raped, that physical aspect is there. And then there's also the online aspect where it gets distributed and there's all the slut shaming and all of that goes on. But what's happening is that there's so much focus on cyberbullying, that whole notion of cyberbullying, and that the spread of it, that the actual physical assault is ignored almost, especially in the media. It's overlooked. And even the policymakers are really not thinking about the fact that there was still a physical assault, the fact that there was rape, and that we need to be teaching about, fostering an understanding of actual violence against women and sexual, you know, objectification and all of that. And I know that, I mean, Kerry would be better in terms of talking about some of the moral panics and all of that. But certainly that is the kind of thing that leads to pressure on policymakers. The other aspect that I'd like to address is the open court system. So a lot of these films and modified postings about sexting and sexism get distributed online. There is, under private law, obviously, the right to sue for defamation. Now, we had a recent case, and again, when I get to that case, I'll talk about how there's a balance between the right of the press to report for free press, and that goes back to the feudal system. There is always a right that the plaintiff has to disclose their identity under private law. But a recent Supreme Court of Canada decision has disclosed that victims who want to sue their perpetrators, especially when this kind of cyberbullying is involved, have a right to remain anonymous. However, because the court doesn't want to open up the floodgates to litigation, I mean, the courts are very careful about how much they'll allow, that they also, and in due respect to free expression, I mean, we have to be allowed to do that, they allowed the facts of the case to be disclosed, so that the person has to remain anonymous, and then the facts have to be disclosed. So, you know, we can maybe later have a discussion about how do you balance that. It's difficult. And then again, what assumptions inform the way that judicial decisions are made. Now, rape culture as a form of cyberbullying. I'm not going to show that little video clip. I'm sure all of you have seen it on the media, the one with at St. Mary's. Has anyone not seen it? I think you've all seen it in terms of normalized rape culture. And apparently, there was also an incident at UBC that has been they've put in some educational responses, as well as they've been punished. I was listening to CBC the other day, and there was a professor from St. Mary's, Mark, I didn't quite catch his name, but he said that the response that UBC had made to their fresh students was too harsh, and that is going to suppress free expression, and that free expression should be allowed at any cost. In the school context, and he was adamant that these kids that by punishing these kids or disciplining these kids through suspensions or whatever prevents dialogue, prevents free dialogue. So again, where do you define the line with these things? On my way here, I was listening to Gian Gomeshi on CBC, and he was interviewing a British author called Ian. It's gone. It'll come back. Ian Leslie, and he's written a book about how gossiping is a good thing, and that online, because of our awareness of how detrimental gossip can be to people, that it's a bad thing. A tempering gossip online is a negative thing, that gossip is a good thing because, especially in the workplace, it allows people to really know what the hidden employer agenda is. So you know, there are all kinds of discussions about free speech. To what extent can we, in all of these areas, allow, you know, where do you cut speech off? Where do you... Where is it that we are actually harming someone through our gossip and rumors? And young people need to be engaged in the dialogue about understanding what's malicious. In Quebec, one of the things to prove defamation and harm to somebody, you've got to, first of all, it has to be unfair comment. It has to be, if it's true, but malicious, somebody can be liable for defamation. Or if it's untrue and an ordinary person would believe it to be true. And again, I'll show you some quotes in that regard. Now, one of the other things, and I'd be interested in your response to that, is whether the media glorifies suicide for young people when they repeatedly see these suicide notes by people like Amanda Todd, and more recently, you know, there have been so many where they're holding up the boards and going, you know, into, and in many cases, there is a body of literature that's emerging that says that this actually tempts people who are being victimized. It sees, it makes them think that this is their last opportunity to publicize what they're feeling, and that and young people don't realize the finality of suicide, I guess, many of them, and so that's dangerous. So at the one end, one extreme, there's the Nova Scotia case that I'll talk about, where the girl wanted to remain anonymous, but did not want anyone to know her identity as a victim. And at the other extreme, there are these parents of young women who have committed suicide after they've been raped and their photographs distributed, that are speaking up very publicly. But the question then becomes, are they giving a platform to cappers and trolls to continue the abuse? And, you know, then there's also the fact that celebrities, Lady Gaga, Madonna, Miley Cyrus, have set, they've set sort of trends in terms of liberated, sexually liberated women who are strong, you know, are strong role models for some young women. Miley Cyrus, of course, has been really victimized vitriolically for what she's done, for her videos and concerts. But at the other end of it, that continues to pervade the androcentric, misogynist dialogue in comedy, reality shows, consumer ads, you know, that kind of thing. So, and what really bothers me is that all of this is modeled by adults in society, and yet when we talk about cyberbullying and we talk about laws against cyberbullying, it's all about the kids. The kids are bad. You know, you've got to control the kids. You've got to manage the kids. But these kids are only following models that exist in society. These kids are following models that are so embedded systemically and, you know, in the societal, you know, it's almost hegemonic. Okay. I think I've gone through. That we are finding, as I've said, a higher tolerance for insults, jokes, and pranks. There's one case from California that is not in the four that I'm going to discuss. To tell me if I'm going way over time. Okay. Where there was a young Justin Bieber type of young man who was doing very well musically. He had a contract to make a movie, and he had set up a website, and he had posted that he has golden brown eyes, and he invited people to write on his guest book about his photographs and his music and everything. And I guess that statement, "I have golden brown eyes," irked people so much, his classmates or his schoolmates, that they started to have they started to post threats and insults and homophobic, largely homophobic threats. And this young man got really sick. He had to drop out of school. He lost his contract, movie contract, because I guess the producers were homophobic. He had to move out to another neighborhood. And when he brought an action for defamation against these kids, the worst perpetrator who made the worst threats said, "I don't even know this person, and I don't care. I didn't even know this person. I was just irritated." And here is something that sort of looks at the norms of communication sometimes among digital natives. That is, he said anybody in my generation would understand why that statement, "I have golden brown eyes," would offend people and upset them and irritate them. How you work that, you know. But anyway, in that case, the judge said, that didn't make sense. But he also said that he was just joking. And there have been so many cases of just joking. There was Abbott Ball, who a 28-year-old in Montreal, who had threatened his former teachers online, female teachers, and wanted to shoot them and had posed with guns. And he lived with his parents still. When the police went to arrest him, he had the guns, unregistered, and also said, but his parents said, oh, he was just joking. He would never do that. And you won't believe the number of times in all of these cases we hear, we were just joking. We didn't mean it. So where is that line where you actually start to mean it? And an Austrian study in 2012 found that, you know, looking at motivation for young people, found that anger and fun are at the top of youth motivation. Anger and fun. So sending off a girlfriend's picture when she split up with you, if she had sent you an intimate picture, and distributing it. There was a case in the States where a girl committed suicide because her boyfriend sent it to 70 people, and one of them was her grandmother. So here are, four cases that have some of these issues. 16-year-old girl in Maple Ridge was gang raped a few years ago in 2010. It was videotaped by a 16-year-old who then passed it on to his friend to post on Facebook. Now the question arises, if you're videotaping a rape and you want to give it to someone, why not give it to the police instead of putting it up online? But again, that notion, that whole generation thing of posting things right away, posting things. And he was charged with child possession and distribution of child pornography. This went so viral that the police in BC had to announce that anyone caught in possession of this video would be charged with child pornography, distribution of child pornography. The judge said at the hearing that he has matured significantly. And he gave him a one-year probation, and get this, told him to write an essay on the evils of the internet. That tells me, you know, that is an indication. That's why we so define the line. Part of my Inside Shirk grant, and we're going into this phase now, is we're going to do focus groups and surveys with judges to help them, to glean how they're thinking about the internet and how they're thinking about kids. And digital communication, and we've already done our research on asking similar survey questions and focus groups with the pre-Facebook age children, 9 to 12, and then 13 to post-Facebook, 15 to 17, on how they define the line between jokes and teasing and this kind of thing, and how they define the lines between public and private spaces. And Claudia Mitchell, actually my colleague in education, had done some very interesting work with South African girls on posting online diaries online and how they thought about where these girls posted everything personal about themselves in negligees and pictures of their bedrooms and all of this. But they said, but it's a private conversation. They're public-private diaries because they're only targeted, they're only supposed to be for our friends, but they're online. So, help. But definitely looking at the assumptions that judges bring and lawmakers bring. And I am actually talking to the Dean of Law because I want to teach some courses in law school because I really think that some of the pre-lawyers need to have understand these issues. Now, with Amanda Todd, again, that whole big publicity when she died, and there were confusing reports about the fact that the capper, the person who extorted the photograph, who engaged in extortion for her to, first of all, to pose for the picture, and then when he was telling her to do more and she refused, he sent it off to her classmates and everybody else and put it online on social media. Does everyone know what a capper is? So my understanding of it is that cappers are groups of generally pedophiles that share these kinds of images and pornographic images and coerce young women into posing for these kinds of photographs. But the difference was, so the cappers, when they're sharing this among themselves, what was the difference? And I'd like to have some of your opinions. Is what was the difference between that and once her friends saw it online and started to engage in relentless cyberbullying, embarrassing kinds of posts and statements, and to the extent that she finally ended up committing suicide? Is there a difference? And what, obviously there is, but how do we define that to the lawmakers? Because the lawmakers don't seem to realize it. And the people like Amanda's mother and other family members, even with Rutaia Parsons, are pushing for legislation and pushing for awareness. But in Amanda's case, her suicide note really did give a platform for even trolls. Now, trolls are people who post offensive insults, sexualized statements after the person has died. And this continues. You know, there were comments about, oh, she tried to drink bleach the first time and it didn't work, and then she did this. I mean, you know, but so why not? Also, we need to work with the media about how insensitive this can be. Yes, we have had enough publicity about these kinds of incidents. What we need now is more informed reporting, which allows freedom of the press, which allows free expression, but reporting that will also not allow too much, not provide platforms to these kinds of people to continue that abuse. Again, it's a fine balance of how do you get the information out, how do you get people knowledge about these issues, and how do you draw the attention of the lawmakers, but you also have to get the right type of attention from the lawmakers. You also have to get the lawmakers to think carefully instead of behaving reactively, instead of just responding reactively. I need to go faster. Rutaia Parsons, you've all heard a lot about her, and her parents have been very active lobbying with both the Nova Scotia government and the federal government. And she, her case was, I'm not very as familiar with the Steubenville case, but I think there were a lot of similarities in the fact that she was, but it was similar to the Maple Ridge case where she was raped and drugged and these images were sent and kept coming back. So that has resulted in the Nova Scotia Cyber Safety Act. And I've looked at that quickly. Basically, one on the pro side, I think that it's quite comprehensive because it does allow, it doesn't just look at the behavior, it allows for systemic influences. It talks about the range of racism, sexism, homophobia. It talks about the fact that cyberbullying is rooted in these issues, and it also allows for defamation suits. So it almost gives permission for young people and young women to sue their perpetrators in private action, and it holds parents responsible, parents of those kids who are the perpetrators responsible. And then, so that's the Rutaia Parsons case. At the other end, as I mentioned, is the AB versus Bragg communications case, where somebody created an employee of Bragg Communications, developed a Facebook page in AB's name, put pictures of her and made sexually compromising comments, and she wanted to sue her perpetrator, but unlike Amanda Todd and the others, she wanted to be her privacy protected, and she went to the lower court in Nova Scotia and both the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia and the Court of Appeal showed the similar kind of insensitivity that was shown in the Maple Ridge case. Basically, the Court of Appeal said to her, well, you know, we need to know, the public needs to know more about bullying, so you should disclose your identity because then you'll be a leader in talking about these issues. But we've already heard enough about these issues. That was pretty insensitive, and some of the wording, if you want, you can contact me and I can always give you those the links to those cases. So she wanted to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, and I got a call from her lawyers at the very last minute and said, we have to file on Tuesday, we need evidence to explain to, in our leave to appeal to the Supreme Court, we need evidence to say, to explain why AB would want to remain anonymous. Why does she want her identity protected? And so, we put together an affidavit really fast that bringing in a lot of the research, Yabara and Mitchell and a whole lot of some of my colleagues at Stanford, Ryan Kahlo, who talks about privacy harm, and we put together a whole affidavit to and Hinduja and Patchin, who have talked about suicide and bullycide, and to explain that, you know, the threat of further bullying is really huge, as well as simply just not wanting to be out there it all over the place, being reported on. And so that's where we then got interveners involved. We got based on our affidavit, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case. And we then got Kids Help Phone involved. I think we got the Anuradha's organization. Were you involved as an intervener? No, you weren't. Okay. But there were other, I think Coalition of Children's Rights, a lot of interveners on behalf of both the press and AB. And the Supreme Court ended up agreeing that they called it discernible harm. Because the notion of harm in law is also something that is very complicated. Because to establish that somebody was harmed, you have to establish that it was the harm was tangible. So how do you, in many of the cyberbullying cases, if it's sexual harassment that's without rape, or say if it's just sexual harassment online, it's hard to establish psychological harm because how tangible is it? In the case of Rateo Parsons, yes, there was actual harm, because she was raped, and there was physical evidence of that in the photographs, and the Maple Ridge case. But in AB's case, there was less harm, and so the lower courts basically said, well, she wasn't really harmed, this was just online, so she didn't really get harmed, she wasn't hurt. So their interpretation of harm was wrong. So the Supreme Court said their interpretation of harm was in error, that there is discernible harm, and that it's a very toxic phenomenon. So, but again, people have argued that lawyers have argued that the Supreme Court did not go far enough, because they allowed once you talk about the facts of the case, anyone can recognize this. And someone who works in this area is Jane Bailey at the University of Ottawa Law Faculty, and Valerie Steves. They do some excellent work on this, in this area of law. And they are actually going to be coming to a conference, speak at a conference that I'll tell you about at the end of this presentation. So if you're interested in listening to them. And an earlier Supreme Court decision that is also relevant here. And this is how we're different from the states. Because in the U.S., under our charter, we have to establish under Section 1 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms that any kind of policy or law approach has to be pressing and substantially pressing and substantial in the interests of the greater good. And that if you're infringing somebody's rights, that you do it, that they're being minimally impaired. So there's a balance and a hierarchy of rights as it's balanced in the courts. So again, the question is, who is an ordinary person? You know, are digital natives now, they're ordinary people. They're ordinary person in light of their generation. So what are the parameters of social interaction? What are the norms that they go by? And how are they different from those of digital immigrants? And so it's critical that any laws that we put in understand the differences between adults who grew up in a different era and this. Now, I'll very briefly go through Canadian statutory responses. Provincial legislation, we've had a number of provincial laws that have come out that are targeted at schools and have and want schools to provide a safe school environment and they're forcing them to report to the government, to the ministries of education, on what's taking place in their schools, how much cyberbullying, the nature of it, is it homophobic, is it racist, sexist. But a lot of them have been put together very quickly in a reactive manner. One example is Bill 56, which initially the definition was extremely narrow, and then a whole lot of school boards made submissions and said, you need to change it. They were going to fine schools for not reporting to them within a few months. But by December last year, they all had to report on what was happening in their schools, and there was massive panic. What happened? The schools were so desperate because they did not put the money or the resources. They invested $1.5 million in a public service announcement about Bill 56, but they didn't instead take that money and invest it in resources and education for teachers to know how to implement this law. And so what the teachers did, what they did was they ended up paying consultants who have very little knowledge of these issues between $1,000 and $5,000 to help them do this, to implement this. And so up popped all these people, all these so-called experts on Bill 56. And so, you know, there was all kinds of misinformation happening. The Acceptance Act in Ontario had difficulties because they called for gay straight alliance clubs to be formed, and a lot of the religious parents objected to this. And I have to say something about Quebec's charter of values, and it contradicts Bill 56. So the government is contradicting its own laws because it will definitely increase the level of bullying, especially against girls and women who are wearing hijabs. It's already started to happen. I was quoted in the Gazette and then interviewed on a number of radio stations. Those are on our website at Define the Line. Listen if you can, because we had some very heavy debates about this issue. The Nova Scotia's Act is quite comprehensive, and Manitoba's proposed law is also has attracted the anger by teachers' unions. A number of us presented to the Senate Standing Committee on Human Rights that studied, and that was an interesting study actually, because they were looking at the obligations, Canadian obligations under Article 19 of the International Convention of the Rights of the Child, because we are bound to protect children from abuse under Article 19. And what we told them was that, as well as looking at that, we also need to look at Article 12 of the CRC, because that is about participation. Our record of participation in Canada, children's participation in their learning, is abysmal. And if we want young people to understand some of these issues, we've got to engage them. And that report was put out by Senator Mubina Jaffer, who's also actually coming to the same conference as Jane Bailey. That is actually, they talked to people who research in this area from across the country, including Wayne McKay from Dalhousie, who was the chair of the task force on cyberbullying in Nova Scotia. Concerns about criminalization or over-criminalization of changing the criminal code so that young people end up being punished and charged for when they're engaging in this kind of joking and teasing and that kind of thing. It's where, again, do you draw the line? And Hedy Fry, an MP, had brought in, had proposed amendments to section under Bill C-273. And again, some of us testified, because the wording that they were using in the amendments, they were talking about just broadly about computers and email. There was no mention of any kind of social media or anything like that, as well as that they were talking about intentional harm. And yet so much of this could be unintentional. And our concern, and again, it was, the criminal code doesn't address different aged audiences. It's going to cover you know, adults and young people. And then the Youth Criminal Justice Act is going to address the sentencing aspect of it. But do we really want 12-year-olds to get criminal records you know, what are the implications of this? So rather than that, we should teach them about what those implications might be. And the Canadian omnibus legislation, that Bill C-10, also talked about Safe Streets and Communities Act, and that calls for harsher penalties and longer sentencing for young people. So that, again, is an issue. It needs to be focused to go after the right people. You know, it needs to be focused to go after the actual child sexual predators, the ones who are taking advantage of all of this. So, John Pop, I've just got a couple of slides left. John Palfrey in the U.S. in 2009, he's a Harvard professor that actually thinks along the same lines as we do, and he called for he spoke to the U.S. Congress when it was there. It's not in operation now. As you can see, he basically had the same perspective, that it's really not new laws that we need, but a better understanding of these issues. Basically, what we're doing in our research is we're engaging young people in developing interactive online projects where they tell us how they define some of these lines. And it was interesting because the younger because we had a grant from Facebook that we did a lot of this research under, and I know there's an ethical consideration there sometimes because Facebook can also, you know, the privacy issues. But the kids, 9 to 12, actually are much more concerned about these issues, they told us in focus groups and surveys, than the older kids. They seem to have much more of a compass in terms of where they would, very strong about what kind of a world of communications they want to live in. So basically, you know, we're trying to get kids to think through their postings, and we've got some really interesting exercises that we do with the kids, and I define the line, law students and education and other students have come up with some really good workshops. So again, I took this from one of Claudia Mitchell's books, actually articles, and you know, how do you get young people to engage in and think about how they engage online? And you know, in terms of reflexivity and negotiation, for example, uses of multimedia force young people to look at themselves, to reflect on how others view them, and make informed opinions about others. Claudia Mitchell has done some amazing work in the digital realm with kids, and actually I think some of her students are going to work with us when we bring the kids from the schools here to develop video vignettes, because mine actually need updating, and it would be great. I'll close with this and then one short video that we've developed. So this is the context right now. People are pushing for blanket laws. They're ignoring teens' agency. They're ignoring variables. Sensationalized media quite often can misinform. And please don't get me wrong. I think that in some cases the media does report very responsibly. And when I've talked to them and emphasized what needs to be there, it often, I mean, not needs to be, the message that I want to convey, it does get there in an informed manner. There's a reduced safety platform for cappers, reduced safety platform, which allows cappers and trolls, confuses liability, sustained negative environments. What we really need is even as colleagues in Australia, Kift Campbell et al. Talk, big stick sanctions will not work. That just laws alone are not the answer. We need to balance these issues, free speech, privacy, safety, security, all of those. Ownership and accountability to young people, we've got to work with them. You're not going to, you know, if you don't engage the kids, it's not going to work. There you go. So can we do that video and then we can go to our responders? So this video we developed a few years ago. We developed 6 videos, 3 in English and 3 in French. As part of another research project when we were setting up this website. And, I'm sorry, I do have to show you my website as well, just where it is, what it looks like, so you can go there. So this is part of our website. We're in the process of revamping it. My developers told me this week, but it didn't happen. So they did put that new quote. Okay, good. They're getting there. So we developed 6 videos, 3 in French and 3 in English, and they're only 2-minute vignettes. But teachers have been using them in class to enhance discussion. I want to get a little bit more. I want more to come from kids. I want the kids to develop them, or you know, and teens to develop them, because I think they would be much more. And this is where I think. I'm hoping to work with people who are working in this field. I know Leslie Shade, actually, I don't know if anyone's worked with her at Concordia, does some really good work with young people. Anyway.
Which would you like?
It's the, yeah, this one, the La Photo. And I'm showing you the French one because the English one is a little bit mild. It's not as realistic.
Chinois, ça?
Franchement?
What's it like to feel for Thomas? Ouais.
Hein? C'est pas super.
Hey, nous on en a vu des affaires, hein? T'es une salope.
And so people have also said, you know, when the girls are talking about it, we could have put something else there. We could have got them to be more supportive of the girl. But this is the kind, we want them to think about these things. We want them to discuss. There's a lot in there. Even if we've got some other videos on cyberbullying. There's some nuanced discussion that needs to be taking place among the kids of how, you know, at a younger kid, because the kids in grade 8 actually told us under the Facebook project that they are seeing pictures going around in grade 8. So when you start, we've got to start with younger and younger kids to talk, at least get them talking about the implications. Thank you.
Rich and detailed discussion. I feel like I'm going to just, use that as a foundation and just propose some ideas and questions. It was incredibly rich. I mean, I think one of the things that is interesting and a little bit paradoxical is that on the one hand, kids are inseparable from these technologies. They're on their phone, they're online. They're digital natives, right? And yet, there's this tremendous lack of digital literacy at the same time. And I mean, it's extremely profound. I mean, I usually ask my students at the start of the school year whether they know what source code is, which is, you know, what programs are written in. And they think, wasn't there a movie with, you know, Matt Damon or something?
Yeah.
And ask, you know what system administrator does, and I ask that because that's what Edward Snowden was, and because he's a system administrator, he was able to access all these files, right? And so to me, what's so interesting is that while something like electricity and the technologies that come with electricity power our lives, literally, you know, it doesn't change our lives. I mean, it does change our lives because certain things are possible. But the internet sort of interfaces with everything, the ways we interact and the ways we do our politics, the way we lead our day-to-day lives. And, you know, what your presentation made so clear is that while we need legal remedies, they're extremely important, and yet there's also a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it, unless there's more extensive digital literacy, you know, things can only go so far. And so I was thinking, I mean, this is a question, especially, you know, to you, because you are in an education program. How realistic would it be to have a class called The Internet that you take in eighth grade, which isn't just about things like harassment, it's everything, you know? It is on the culture and politics of the internet, right? And it's kind of like a social studies class, except instead of, you know, only North America, the internet is the other geography that you take. And I really am asking now in a kind of very realistic way, how realistic would it be to change curriculum in a really widespread sense? I mean, so that's one question. Because obviously the material that's being made is amazing, but I think in some ways you need like a social studies class that's called the internet.
It's well overdue.
Yeah, well overdue. And so I think, I mean, that's something... I think it's possible. I think if people came together, you know, you got the MacArthur Foundation, the Bill Gates Foundation, and these sorts of things. So that's just a kind of question idea out there, because I feel like that's the only way, not simply for this, but to create people who can intervene politically in democracy to stop these dynamics. My next, I really think your discussion about the media is so important. And, you know, there's a very similar story actually with Anonymous whereby when the media reports on them, they tend to make their operations more powerful, in fact, and they are a kind of, they're very much part of the ecology that allows Anonymous to spread. But this was my, this is a, another question I had, because on the one hand, I was wondering whether some of these reports, while they definitely contribute to victimization, right, do they act as an educational moment to scare both boys and girls into going, oh my gosh, I don't want that to happen to me. But is it limited because we live in such a, the media landscape is so fragmented in some ways that the exposure is very minimal? Do you see what I'm saying? So obviously in the certain cases become national, but for the most part they stay within just kind of regional areas, and so in some ways it's too patchy to have that kind of mm-hmm. educational mm-hmm. effect. So that was kind of a question that I also had. Two more quick comments. I was fascinated by your discussion about how difficult it is to establish harm, right, and how these judges demarcate offline, online, physical rape from, the sorts of harassments which we do know produce significant psychological effects. And I also just wonder if that's a little bit of an effect of the ways in which the internet was conceptualized early on as this virtual space, disembodied, separate, right? And I do think that there's been a lot of harmful effects from conceptualizing the internet in these ways. So that just made me think about that a little bit. And then finally, I think there are obviously ways to remedy the problem through law and education, and in some instances, there's actual perpetrators that can be targeted and caught, but what you point to is, in many instances, it's very distributed, and while in some cases in schools, someone who's targeted is targeted by people in school, there's some cases that just blow up way beyond the local place, and individuals contribute on certain websites. And it's true that a kind of individual in their one little contribution doesn't feel like they're doing that much harm, because it is one tiny contribution for 3 seconds or something like that, right? And it's good to be aware of that. And I think in some ways, while a lot can be done to remedy certain problems in ways that you have talked about, there will always be the existence of some arenas I don't think we can totally control. But that's okay, because I think sometimes I hang out with a lot of people who are very wary of regulation. Like hackers are like, no, speech, we can't regulate the internet. Yeah. Like, let it be free, so on and so forth. And I mean, one way to kind of capture their hearts and minds is to, marry the message of anonymity and privacy, and then they'll be like, oh yeah, we like that too. You know what I mean? And so that's a good way to kind of get them on board. But one can also recognize and say, look, you're not going to, eradicate this problem 100%, but if you can significantly lower the harms, that's huge. And I think that is the case of real crime as well, right? You have laws and interventions, and it's not like you fully eradicate it, but you jump in there and do something about it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, anyways, those were just some comments and responses to what was a really rich cool. discussion.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Can I quickly respond? Mm-hmm. So thank you very much for your insights. And I think really, so you asked three specific questions. The one about a course in the school system, absolutely. I think we need several courses that can be applied in different subject areas. Because what we're finding is when you just, what has been brought in are anti-bullying programs that are sort of delivered almost didactically in a, and they're seen as programs, and there's school burnout. They don't want to deal with it. So we've got to bring in especially just an improved understanding of more digital literacy among not only, so at the university level, when we're in teacher pre-service programs in faculties of education, as well as with the kids. So there's a whole host of courses that if a number of us got together and developed, with people with your background and expertise, are very, they're well overdue. Your second question, I really wanted to answer now. What was it again?
Well, it was about the media, how I just was wondering if there's been any studies that look at whether they act as educational moments in a positive sense, even though they do definitely can re-victimize.
Yeah.
Do some people, following the Steubenville case, the Amanda Todd case, you know, do kids go, oh, wow, you know, I've got to really think about what I do? Because when I see these things, I think, oh, my gosh, won't people learn from these cases? Or do they, don't they?
I think you've brought up an important point, because I don't know of any studies that there probably are some studies that have looked at this, but what I'm concerned about is that how much news do the kids really watch? Or even in my undergrad class, with this charter of values being on every newspaper, every radio, every internet, every outlet, media outlet, out of a class of 80 undergrad students, I asked how many had been reading about it, and about 4 raised their hands, and these are undergraduates. So at the high school level, half of this, is just going over kids. They don't even realize it. Yes?
We're talking about kids learning from these cases and educating people about the dangers of these things. Are we talking about telling girls, like, that if they send a naked picture of themselves to someone who they trust and has convinced them that they're not going to do anything with that photo, and it totally is like they have this relationship with someone? Is that what we're trying to do? We're trying to tell them that...
We're just trying to hear from, we're trying to get them to develop perspectives, because obviously girls are also, developing their identities, right? I mean, and there's that again, there's that paradox of being objectified, and then the feminist how do girls build their identities? And so, it may be okay to share intimate photographs with somebody that you trust, and yet... it's the distribution, and how do you...
I think that there's a way in which sometimes they don't know that... They first might have an awareness, oh, it could spread, but they don't have enough digital literacy to know that copies are being made on servers. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and they'll never get rid of them.
Having that knowledge can change it so that they print out the photo and share it.
Yes.
And, of course, that person can still take it and scan it and so on and so forth. But it's these sort of techniques that
yes.
have it in their brains. Kids are smart.
Yeah, and that,
they don't even have it there.
No, and that's really important. And no one actually has ever raised this, and I think it's so, so important, because it's overlooked. It's a gap. Yes. Yes.
I have 2 points. I'll try and be brief. Obviously, participation by young people is key, but at the same time, we have to be aware of the fact that historically, regardless of whether the problem is sex ed, racism, poverty, disease, call it what you want, our educational programs have been disastrously bad. And I would suggest having a separate course on the internet will do no good whatsoever. If you want to make improvements, it has to be incorporated in the curriculum as a whole, not just simply one isolated course which can be ignored or ridiculed. Right now, for years, for example, moral religious education was compulsory in the schools, but they had to take the course, but they didn't have to pass it. So it became a joke and was eventually abolished. So my point is, if you're going to rely on education, it has to be an integral approach, not a separate course called Internet. The second point I want to make is, why are we being so easy on parents? After all, at the moment, the law says if an underage child commits a criminal act, the parents are responsible.
Okay.
It seems to me, if we want to get the parents to do their duties, we have to make sure that the law punishes them when their children misbehave. That doesn't mean that we can't reach the children. We obviously do whatever we can to reach the children. But we're letting the parents off the hook much too easily.
I don't think we're letting parents off the hook as much, and the Nova Scotia Cyber Safety Act actually is holding parents responsible for their children's behavior, the perpetrators. But I think that, there needs to be digital literacy among parents, educators. This, you know, the last 10 years has been unprecedented in terms of how communication has evolved. And our education system, it just cannot keep up, has not kept up. And also, it's, you know, sometimes we can, I feel like I'm hitting the, I keep banging on a blank wall because, or deaf ears, because our schools are not open to move, you know, to evolving as fast. Even in our university faculties of education, they're not willing to make the changes. And yes, absolutely, we have to embed these literacies, digital and legal, into every aspect of school curriculum and school life. But I think your point is also well taken, that you also need, you know, you need specific courses, just like you have math courses, in understanding the technicalities, as well as then bringing some of this into different courses. Because it's an evolution, and we don't have precedents. And there's a lot of pushback as well. So it's happening slowly. But what I found is teachers are always saying to me, give us a toolkit. Tell us what to do. They want a rubric and a toolkit and what to do. There isn't one. You've got to, you know, they need to also shift their way of thinking. And yes, parents absolutely do need to be educated. Because it's difficult. Okay, so now she's had you've had your hand up way up, and then I'll come back to you, and then I'll go to you. Yeah.
You said something about how these girls don't know that these photos will spread, but the photos aren't like self-replicating. They're not just spreading like you put it out in the world. It just spread. They're being spread by people.
Yeah.
And I just think that that video you showed, like, we didn't even see the person who shared the photo. This girl shared a photo with someone who obviously she trusted, and that person spread it to lots of other people. We didn't even see that. The whole video was focused on the girl and what she did and the consequences that she brought on herself.
Yeah, but quite often they don't. They don't know who spread it. Quite often that's the problem is, you know, they don't know who spread it, or, this video is simply to start the kind of dialogue that we're having. Just to think, you know, to come so that they can talk about different situations, different scenarios. That all we want to do is generate a dialogue and get them thinking about these issues. Can I go to this other person first and then come back to you? Is that all right?
I have a couple things, and I think maybe the point that Rowan was bringing up, or that I might like reinforce with that, is that when we start the dialogue, if we can shift the spotlight to the perpetrators, the people who are sharing.
Well, there are other videos. Yeah, and there are other, yes. And there are other, the other six videos do that. You actually see the perpetrator.
Right.
But
I think we spoke about that a lot
as well
yesterday around, like, responsibilization and who should.
Oh, accountability. Absolutely. And we do, actually, if you go onto our website, you'll see the different videos. And they have, and again, as I said, they are 3 years old. They need to be updated. And we, if you want to give us feedback, please do. You know, we really want to change them. Okay. Did you want to?
Oh, yeah. I was just saying the internet course wouldn't be like a moralizing course. It would be a course that looks at everything like who invented the internet.
Yeah.
So there's a history part. And then you learn a little bit about how it works. A part on activism and the internet and the Arab Spring, right? And so there's case studies that then bring in it's kind of cultural historical analysis, like a social studies class, but then also digital literacy at the very same time, you know. And so there could be a course or a section on kind of sexuality in the internet as well, and you read a communications scholar. So I don't see it as a kind of moralizing kind of public health or PSA course, but, you know, if we're going to learn about world cultures, the internet is so significant in our life. It is a kind of geography. It is a geography. It's just not, you know, Latin America, but it's the internet, and one can make a very interesting course and sneak it in a way that's not moralizing.
Mm-hmm.
The second it's moralizing,
it may
not work.
Yeah, you can. That doesn't work. And one of the other things that I forgot to mention is that a lot of the perpetrators of this kind of stuff are also victims quite often and are responding, are angry, you know, as that study showed.
Things like laws and school courses, I think, are critical components in a much larger overall fight, but I'm thinking, like, I have friends that worked on, for example, the MSG project to bring gender studies to high schools in Ontario. And that's been, like, an 8-year struggle. The government spent, like, tens of millions of dollars. I mean, if it took a fraction of that time to develop an internet course, it'd be irrelevant before it even, you know, so how do you get it? And the way I think to do that is, like, instead of, like, you know, Quebec or Ontario schools trying to develop this curriculum, like, why don't they just, like toss, for example, like, $5 million with, like, I don't know, Project Respect and be like, you're going to, like, go to every high school in the country over the course of X amount of years.
If I could do that, if I could get them to do that, honestly, they yeah, just, no, yeah.
But, I mean, how can we change the education system to recognize that there are people that have the tools already to teach this, and they could do it, like, tomorrow, they just need access, right?
We have been
so
trying.
So we ought to be thinking about how can we take the knowledge that's already out there and being done and, like, just fast-track it into our schools as opposed to trying to institutionalize knowledge that's already being disseminated.
Yeah, it's a very difficult undertaking. We've been trying. I mean, if you think about how the ministry has just put in, you know, $1.9 million into advertising a charter that is discriminatory, how do you change that? How do you get them to put money where it's really needed? It's almost impossible.
Well, I just wanted to say, when we're talking about education, I think, like, there's something about curriculum, certainly, that would be really worthwhile to examine how we can integrate these things into curricula, but there's also this thing about the structure and administration of schools that, just in the policies and the ways that teachers and administration respond to students and to girls in particular, reinforce things like victim blaming and slut shaming on a, like, a grand scale. So we're talking about the internet as a tool to do misogyny and slut shaming, all those things. So when teachers put in dress codes about what girls should and shouldn't wear, when they sexualize middle school girls who wear, like, spaghetti strap tank tops, when they're responding to girls and telling them they're dressing inappropriately, when they're talking about sex and sexuality in particular ways to students, when they're responding to us, when we have concerns about students in particular ways, we can see that we have this entire institution that's supporting students to learn these things that you were talking about. So when you were saying, like, students aren't just learning, you know, they're not just, like, coming up with slut shaming and homophobia on their own, it's part of the fabric of our culture.
Sure.
It becomes more about the institution itself than what we're learning in our classrooms. And so, and we know this because our youth team has been doing also workshops with teachers, and, you know, we do this bystander intervention things, and, you know, teachers are so, because of all this focus on homophobia, they're so willing to jump in when someone says that's so gay or whatever, but when we have a scenario around slut shaming,
yeah.
We had one teacher say, well, I would have to fact check before I knew if I should intervene in that, like,
selection.
Really was a slut. Like,
selection.
You know, and we're like,
selective interventions, yeah.
You know, it's like, what? And so,
yeah.
It's about how are we even training our teachers, how are we even shaping our schools.
There needs to be a huge overhaul of educational, of faculty of education courses. We really need to have a huge, you know, huge changes in the way that we deliver our courses. Good luck, I'm trying.
Steph, did you have a comment or question back?
Well, I guess, like, I was going to say in response to what you were raising about the institutions, you know, that it's one of those chicken or the egg things, right? Because the institutions are us. And, like, how do we change the institutions without changing the way that people think? And how do we change the way that people think in a really massive way without taking advantage of the institutions that have influence? The media is another institution that has a great deal of influence and where a lot of these changes could take place. But there are some faculties of education have really amazing specializations in anti-oppression models. Like, I know the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at U of T has one. But, I mean, the ideal scenario would be if anti-oppression was woven into all teacher education and not something. Because then, you know, if people are choosing that specialization, it's probably going to be preaching to the choir for the most part. So, yeah, I don't have any answers, unfortunately, but I wanted to chip in.
And I think I agree with you. I think it's we can foster the changes, and there are some really good initiatives out there, and it's finding them and trying to maybe bring people together to make the changes where we need them. Absolutely. I'm sorry. There's just one more. How much can I take? One more?
Yes.
Please.
Hi. Thank you for your really awesome presentation.
I'm thinking, you know, when you asked, what's the, like, where do we draw the line in terms of deciding when language is dangerous and when, like, a certain kind of approach is not. To me, the answer was not that complicated, but I don't know how that could translate into, I guess, legislative process or some sort of, you know, to be able to galvanize support in, I guess, in the societal, administrative, institutional approaches. Because I, as an activist, when I am engaged in community development projects, there's always this imperative to create a safe space for whoever is involved, whoever I'm working with. And so, to me, it's just a matter of kind of expanding that bubble of space where people who come, like clients or young people, whoever it might be, to kind of make ourselves safe for other people. So, like, kind of make ourselves a safe space. And how do you, like, I don't really know how to, I guess, frame it in a way that could make sense.
And again, I hear you. There are many initiatives that create safe spaces. But I suppose the overall question would be why, you know, if you can reduce. I mean, just in general society, in general community, in communications among young people, if they, you know, why should they have to deal? You know, why should we have to deal with these issues? But then. Yeah, I mean, it's complex, and we're living in a world that every day is you're seeing people being shot and killed, and, you know, it's just... definitely creating safe places, and I'm assuming you're saying ourselves individually helping others?
Yeah, but... yes. But I'm also thinking, how could that translate into, like, the legislative kind of... Because that's what you are also, I guess, talking about or questioning. Because the Bill 56... You know, the whole premise of it is to create a safe environment. But the environment, we kind of talk about it as if it's like something that's outside of people. But people are the ones who people the environment. Like, you know.
Well, but and now you don't. You know, I talk about virtual school environment, like physical and virtual school environments as the school environment, because it's not just the physical space; it's the physical and virtual, because it's all. There are no boundaries now.
And,
Yeah, and that's a whole other discussion that we need to have. So I'm going to give you the last word, and then we'll close.
Now I'm going to ask the final question. Can we come before that? Yeah, please.
I guess it was very interesting to see hear your talk, and also like how you also work with youth around those issues. There's this initiative in Ontario that's led by. I'm not exactly sure how, but I think it's like a combination of like the Sexual Assault Center Association in Ontario. That's called Where We Draw the Line, and they interact on social media with youth. Maybe that's their goal. And they're reevaluating right now their thing. And I think I'd like to hear you more talk about like, a little bit about agency, of the youth who do take those pictures, and also not just like in the spreading afterwards, but also in, yeah.
Yeah, agency, and you saw that in my diagram at the end. Agency is important. It's huge. You've got to give the kids agency.
Can you elaborate? Because the legal world doesn't really care about agency as much, right? In a lot of ways.
So no, because there's substantive law and there's positivist law, and the positivist, which is a letter of law, so more of the criminal type sanctions, no, you know, their end is to sort of basically control and punish. I talk about in the school context discipline as having an educational component, so there's that aspect, but there's also developing agency in young people, which we don't do enough of in our schools. Absolutely, giving, you know, hearing, and one way that you know is give them responsibility for certain forms of communication, certain so that's what we're trying to do at different age levels, you know. And we were looking at, because a lot of the pre-Facebook kids are already on Facebook. They're not, even though it's the legal age is 13, they're already on there. So, you know, how do you get them to think about what they're seeing among the older kids and how they're dealing with it? And I found actually that they were quite more, they were better informed and more thoughtful in their responses. Agencies, yeah. Okay, I know my responder has been wanting to.
It's a purely empirical question that just hit me recently. So yesterday in class, I did a little bit of history on women and labor. And you know how women used to get, if you were a flight attendant, you were fired if you got married through the 70s and, you know, even beginning the 80s, if you were pregnant, you know, until laws were passed, you can get fired. And, you know, I think the perception now is, you know, if you're pregnant, you keep your job. And so this was my question. Is rape culture in high school, is it worse or better, the same? Do we even have data to get a sense of shifts over the last 20 years related to that within middle school and high schools in North America?
From what I understand, it is worse. That we've just, so our study, we're just in the process of coding some of the responses. So I don't have exact percentages for you or, you know, but there is, we're actually, my group, they're actually just coding some of the responses. And so, yeah, in a few weeks I can let you know. And I don't know, you know, we have to look at other studies on this definitely, because I think apparently it is in the university. See, that top of the digital native generation at university age, there's definitely a rape culture sort of. In one of my books, Truths and Myths, there's a chapter by Ellen Kraft, and she wrote about the juicycampus.com. And that chapter, I think she's looked at some of the studies, for sure. Sorry, the questions keep coming. I don't know.
Take my prerogative. That's a good question. We've been talking a lot over the symposium about consent and building consent cultures and trying to shift the focus from the notion that girls, that teenagers, that adults are individually responsible for things that happen to them.
Yeah.
Right, and it seems to me that the calls for digital literacy and the calls for legal literacy are really important, but they're still kind of defined in terms of giving the tools to the individual not to do something that will cause someone else to hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and we've been trying to sort of talk about, again, we had a great workshop yesterday on sort of how do you build a culture of mutual consent.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and how do you do so in a context that might also challenge some of the ways in which we think about the law as the answer?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think many of us are also interested in decriminalizing the response
mm-hmm.
to distribution and non-consensual distribution, mm-hmm. which is what we're talking about mm-hmm. in many of these cases. And I'm wondering if you've been coming across any that do that work.
Yes.
That aren't about, you know, you ask the question, like, do we treat, you know, the kids who, or teenagers, or whoever we want to say this is, who are redistributing things the same as the original person who has forwarded something, right? I would say, I don't want to lock everybody up. I don't think that's actually going to help, right? So how do we decriminalize that, but hold distributors, non-consensual...
Yeah, and also look at it in terms of...
accountable.
Yeah, absolutely, and also look at it in terms of the girls are just not passive objects that things are happening to, that, you know, that's, again, that question of agency and all of that. There is one of my Stanford affiliates has started a website called Not Without My Consent, and it's a legal website. It's on, if you can find that one, that you know, it talks about the legalities of consent and helping women who have, or girls and women who have gone through this kind of thing, and some guidelines on what to do, how to understand it.
Well, what constitutes legal consent?
Yes.
Versus
yeah.
A more community set of standards of consent.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's another whole area that I think. Have you read a lot of work by Yabara and Mitchell and Warlack? I'll send you some references, or you know, maybe you can post them.
Yeah.
But there is a whole body of literature that looks at these specific types of issues. And yeah, absolutely.
Ron, did you have a final question?
Oh, there's so much, and this is a lot of stuff. I share your fear about laws that criminalize youth. I think, I'm a prison abolitionist, so I don't believe any prison is a good prison, because I think it's violent. I think our culture puts people in prison and they come out far more violently when they went in, and we have to think of other ways of dealing with that, and that's why I'm involved in...
Can I get you to speak? I can't.
Sorry, yes, and I think violent prison, it's like an incubator for violence, right? I know people that went in there for stealing a T-shirt and came out, you know, beating the crap out of their partners because the violence they experienced while in prison. So I think prisons in and of themselves are reactive and will never be beneficial. I also, when we talk about laws, it's difficult because historically when something happens, let's say there's a tragedy and realize, oh, we don't actually have the legal capacity to deal with this, so they create a law, and that way if that instance ever happens again, we can prevent it. It's just this constant recognition that, like education, when you make changes to education, it's always like kind of like created reactively, and like I just think... with technology and speeding up the process, trying to deal with things like you know, people inappropriately sharing people's images without their consent, definitely. But I also think we have to look forward, and it's like, I don't want to wait till the next child dies in Newfoundland or whatever before we conceptualize what problem that could be. Like, we have to start trying to conceptualize things that aren't already in our lexicon, because at that point, you know, by the time we learned about the problematics of unconsensually sharing pictures, somebody, you know, hundreds of kids have already had to die, right? And so it's like we need to try to find a like more creative.
Yeah, but what, and I suppose what I was trying to say in my presentation is that the way it's done now is through the media and these sensational reports and the parents trying to raise awareness by. It's almost like a shock value, you know, creating shock value for the public, and then, you know, the public will mobilize and say, you know, we've got it, we need new laws. But, you know, we have laws against murder, we have laws against rape, it still happens, right? So how, you know, so what other ways, because this is not, it seems that the more these things are publicized, as I said, suicide is sometimes glorified, that, you know, there's often a rash, especially in Nova Scotia, they had about six, seven, eight in 1 year. It's a lot, you know. So what are they watching the others and thinking, oh, you know what? Well, maybe this is my way out. These are kids. These are just young kids, and I don't. It's very scary. So yeah, a lot of areas that we can research. It's sometimes in this field, it's so hard to keep up with all the research in these different fields, and I think this is where we really need to collaborate. We absolutely, you know, in different, you know, so with your institute and with the Women's Foundation and with some of you, you know, I think we really, really need to, and digital literacy, absolutely. Anuradha, last one, and then Kerry, okay. And then that's it.
Sorry.
Yesterday to some extent today is the intersectionality and how women of different status socially, economically, or girls, or how that plays out differently in the digital universe, and whether there is actually any difference or not. And some of the things that come to mind is how much do we know about that, and to what extent can we say this is a general issue, or this is an issue about certain girls or certain women in certain socioeconomic, or, you know, we don't hear about, I have to say personally, and I keep my ears open, I don't hear about what happens to girls of color in this situation. I don't hear about what happens to Indigenous girls in this situation. I only hear about what happens to white girls in this situation.
That's a
problematic.
Very good question. I mean, generally, I don't know if you're familiar with Shireen Razak's work at all. Have you read on intersectionalities and on intersecting and interlocking, what she calls and this is older, I haven't looked at some of her more recent work, but she also talks about, you know, populations that are incarcerated, you know, Aboriginal populations, representative populations. But so she's done a lot of work, you know, on, she had written a book actually that came out just before September 11th, and it's called Looking White People in the Eye, and just cultural nuances, you know, of how eyes, you know, people's eyes are red and all of that. But intersecting and interlocking barriers. So, you know, someone might be lesbian, but might also be black, experiencing different you know, different kinds of barriers, or there's any number of combinations, right, that you can get, and all of these play out differently. And that's the other thing that the courts are not aware of. And when they even draft these laws and implement them, you know, none of these come into play, and they just apply these sentences as you know, blankly. And maybe, you know, that's the other thing, is our entire justice system needs to be revamped in contemporary society. We're living in a very different society. So yes, yeah. A lot of you have raised questions about certain types of research that really need to be looked at, and I think we need to look at what's happening in those areas.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Shereen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Shereen. Yeah.
We have time for a coffee break. I believe there's some dessert and coffee and tea up there. And we will reconvene for those of you who are interested if we'd like to continue talking a bit further. We're supposed to convene at 3. Maybe we'd start a little bit earlier because it's just we got about 25 minutes. There aren't desserts. Okay, there's still lunch,
but
though.
Delicious chicken.
Okay, good.